From 90.9 WBUR, I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston. On the show today, the new chairman of the Massachusetts Democratic Party looks ahead to 2018 and challenging Governor Charlie Baker.
Right now, he hasn't stood up to the president's appointment, Steve Bannon, specifically. We need to position him on a daily and weekly basis with what the president is doing and why he needs to stand up stronger for Massachusetts.
Also, Boston considers banning plastic bags.
20 tons of plastic bags are in our residential single-stream recycling stream every single month. It is not uncommon to see a plastic bag up in a tree or in a storm drain.
Plus, Major League Baseball adopts new rules limiting rookie hazing, like the Dorothy outfit that Brandon Moss wore in his rookie year.
How does this feel, kid?
Fantastic. Natural. I'm just kidding. That's a joke. I'm just kidding. Feels good.
That's all next on Radio Boston. First the news.
Thanks for listening to the Radio Boston podcast. If you'd like to support WBUR, go to radioboston.org and click the pledge button in the upper right-hand corner. Okay, back to the show.
This is Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. Today and tomorrow, we're going to be speaking with the two chairs of the two major political parties in Massachusetts. Tomorrow, we're looking forward to speaking with Kirsten Hughes. She's the chair of the Massachusetts Republican Party. Today, we're joined by the new state party chairman for the Democrats, Gus Bickford. He's a longtime Democratic operative, having worked on the campaigns of John Kerry, Barack Obama, Hillary Clinton, Elizabeth Warren, Martha Coakley, and many others. Gus Bickford, welcome to Radio Boston.
Thank you for having me.
I first actually wanted to start off by asking you sort of a national level question here, because I was reading an op-ed in the New York Times today written by Dahlia Lithwick. And she was asking, quote, this is a quote from the Times, "If you've been asking yourself, where are the Democrats? You're not alone. Since the election, top Democrats have been almost absent on the national stage. Rather, they've been involved largely in internecine warfare about how much to work with Mr. Trump." Do you think that's a fair criticism of the Democrats right now?
I read the same article, and no, I don't. I think that there was actually a great number of us. She actually says, where were we in 2000 for the recount? My wife took time off for her job, was in Florida for 57 days. I was down there for a good 10 days on our own time, and there was a tremendous amount of Democrats from across the country that participated in that recount. And I think that you're seeing the same type of activity right now in people speaking up against the nominees, people helping as volunteer lawyers for the recounts and funding many of the recounts. And so I know the Democratic Party may not have a national voice just frankly because we are in the process of electing a national chair. That being said, Elizabeth Warren couldn't be more out front and a stronger voice than many other people. And, you know, I think that you've seen our congressional delegation stand up. So, no, there are Democrats there, and a lot of times people forget that they are the Democrats and voices of the party. And I think here in Massachusetts, I've been in meetings for the last 14 days where people are really looking for and doing terrific work.
Okay, so I want to talk with you about the state level in just a minute here, but in the immediate aftermath of the presidential election, there was, of course, this spasm of questioning amongst Democrats. It's still going on about, you know, what should the next step be for the party? How could the party have missed so many key voters who ended up voting for Donald Trump? Does the party need new leadership? And they had the opportunity in the House to elect a new minority leader, but the Democrats in the congressional level ended up staying with Nancy Pelosi. Was that the right choice?
The answer is yeah. More than two-thirds of the House members chose. You know, I wasn't part of that. More than two-thirds of our membership here in Massachusetts chose Nancy Pelosi. I think that we've got great diversity in our party. I think that we need to, and we are recognizing that we need to deliver our message better and in a different way. And I don't think that we didn't hear that message. And I think, the leaders in our party quite clearly are pushing us to do just that, make sure that we deliver it at a local level and we speak in, frankly, the messages that people can understand and see what makes a difference at a local level. Mm.
So do you think there's an opportunity here for Massachusetts Democrats, the congressional delegation, to, you know, sort of carve out a new leadership position even while in the minority?
Very much so. I mean, I think that one of the unique things that we have specifically here in Massachusetts is we've had a governor that says, let's wait and see. Well, I think we've waited and seen long enough. And so we're going to have, you know, our congressional delegation, our state delegation, many of leaders like me talking about how can we have a nominee who for the Department of Energy who wants to, frankly, do away with it when we were trying to close the Pilgrim Power Plant in 2019. Who is going to take care of those fuel rods? Our congressional delegation will be out front on that and will position the governor and many other Republican leaders on a national level to say, wait, you have to stand up and do what's safe for the citizens of Massachusetts and safe for the citizens of this country.
Mm. Now, I definitely do not want to at all downplay the seismic effects of this presidential election. I mean, it's a historic one. Even in a place like Massachusetts, which, you know, overall 2/3 of the voters here voted for Hillary Clinton, but that means a solid third of folks who cast a vote here in Massachusetts voted for Donald Trump. I mean, is that not also a wake-up call for you as the party head here in Massachusetts?
It's a wake-up call for the towns that voted in favor of Donald Trump over Hillary Clinton. But I will go back to some of the strongest leaders that we've had here in Massachusetts, Ted Kennedy. It was rare that he would win with 80%. He wouldn't. We would always have a 33, a 37, a 44, a 46% that would, you know, vote against some of the strongest people. By the way, who would work across aisles and really do what was good for the people of this country and here in Massachusetts? So, yes, it's a wake-up call, and we need to look, frankly, at the communities where Donald Trump won and some of the areas where, you know, we have been not winning votes on a statewide level, because we're going to need those people to understand, frankly, our message and why it will be better to have a Democrat in the corner office in 2019 for the 2018 election. And so we'll be focused on that, and we know that we need to do that.
So how are you going to do that? Because I'm curious about that. Even here in, you know, at the state level, you look at Massachusetts, and it's always held up as like the bluest of blue in the United States. How are you going to, you know, why did your messaging not reach those voters this time around? I mean, there's a good part of the middle of the state where that's the case.
I'm just going to push back a teeny bit on that, because we did. I mean, we won with Hillary Clinton, but the governor, so let's just talk about the governor in the corner office, was out front, put his name and his face, his reputation on, frankly, the question two, which is how we would restructure the formula for funding charter schools and education.
Well, it would lift the cap on charter schools.
Correct, yeah. And the funding of it. And specifically what we did in that case is we delivered the message at a very local level so that people in each community want to understand it would make a difference in their community. So we had 237 school committees across the state who said this isn't a good thing. But more importantly, there are 351 communities. 333 of those 351 communities voted against question two. That's not close. That's a shellacking, and the governor and his people outspent us by $10 million. So we need to do the same thing and point out the differences that we have with the governor. We do want him to work together with the legislator, and we want our legislative leaders to work with him. But frankly, we also want to point out why it would be better for them to have a Democrat in the corner office after 2018.
So education is one thing. It's a complicated one, though, because, I mean, President Obama, obviously former Secretary of Education Arne Duncan, there are many prominent Democrats who actually support the idea of charter schools quite enthusiastically. So it's not necessarily a Republican versus Democratic thing.
No, but
here,
question two wasn't about whether you're in favor of charter schools or not. It was about, again, it was more complicated than that. It was about the funding and lifting of the cap, and because we do use charter schools, but we also have other magnet schools that are just as good. So I was pointing out that we delivered a good and quality message here in Massachusetts in 2016 for question two. But moving forward, we need to point out that the governor is the CEO of the state. Okay, we need someone to stand up, frankly, against the nominees for EPA, because we've got clean water. Okay, we've got to worry about what's going to happen with Jeff Sessions, who's got some serious, significant civil rights positions that, you know, he's going to be our AG. When it comes to, you know, right now with ExxonMobil head being proposed for our Secretary of State, when you look at some of the things that ExxonMobil has done on an international level and, frankly, governments that they've bribed and taked over, and that's my position, you know, it worries me. And so the governor needs to, frankly, be out front and say, as a CEO of the state, this is not at the state level. This is not good for us. We have our national leader, our federal leaders in Elizabeth Warren and Ed Markey doing that. We need, you know, our governor to take a position because he is a voice for us. And so far, he's just said, wait and see. That's not good enough.
Okay, so I can see where the thrust of your energies are and where they're going to be in the next year. You're looking at the governor's office here for the state Democratic Party. But I mean, to be perfectly honest, even if Charlie Baker today came out and said all of these things, am I right in saying that I don't think that would satisfy you as the chair of the state Democratic Party?
It would be a step in the right direction. I mean, one of the biggest differences that he will have in 2018 compared to when he ran in 2014 was that he's going to have a record to run on. So, you know, we're going to be able to talk about, frankly, him returning, you know, his stewardship, frankly, of the commuter rail system. And basically one of the things that, you know, frustrates many people who take the commuter rail is basically the lack of service, the canceled trains. Why are we shipping trains out of state to be fixed? Why can't we fix them here in Massachusetts? And frankly, he's had long enough to deal with this, and it looks as though he has not been able to be a good, you know, the buck stops here, take management into consideration and make it work.
Well,
for
perhaps
him
on those things, but he's done a good job on opioids. He's been quite
well,
quite
just
vocal.
90 and, cuts. Are, well, he's been I quite. Mean, let's look at the
well,
back
he
end. Of
he
that.
Had a bill too. I mean,
yeah, but so in this past, you know, basically what just happened with the 90 cuts is he cut many of the programs that, you know, are important. He'd cut monies for Gloucester. He cut monies for other new programs and officers that were to be put in place to help on the opioid crisis. They no longer stand. And so, you know, that's good rhetoric, but we've got to see what happens behind the scenes. He actually, one of the things that, you know, has happened twice is he's taken tough moves, and then he's run away and not defended them. And so, you know, we'd like it to see him stand here and say why that, you know, why it's important, you know, at this cycle to make those moves.
So I can anticipate that we'll be hearing a lot more from the Democratic Party about Governor Baker in the weeks and months and the years to come. But let me ask you, if right now someone said to you, Gus Bickford, make the case for me why we should have a Democrat back in the governor's office and once again have an all-Democratic state-level government. Because, you know, it turns out, I think that Massachusetts, in a way, ironically, has made some of its greatest strides forward with opposing parties controlling the governor's office versus Beacon Hill.
Well, I mean, let's talk a little bit about some of the things that we're going to be faced with. We're going to be faced with possibly the national health care system being dismantled. We're going to be faced with transportation projects being cut. It would be important for us to have someone who is, frankly, in a position to be advocating on our behalf so that we don't lose those federal monies and standing, you know, basically so that our bridges, our train systems, you know, our highways are maintained and kept. And frankly, we need, you know, we have had strong leaders in the past that has done that. And right now we seem to have a governor that is much more in favor of just looking for some private person to take over who's not accountable to the public. And I don't think that I'd like government working for us. I like to be able to point to someone and say, okay, that's the person to complain to other than Keolis, which, you know, a famous, you know, who is it that you complain to when they're in charge of something? The only person that I can think of is the governor.
And he'll hear your complaints, maybe. Well, Gus Bickford, thank you so much for coming in. I look forward to many more such vigorous conversations with you as time goes by.
Thank you for having me.
Gus Bickford is the new elected chairman of the Massachusetts Democratic Party. Tomorrow we'll be speaking with the chair of the Massachusetts Republican Party, Kirsten Hughes. We'll be back. I'm Meghan Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston. This is Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. There are almost 40 Massachusetts cities and towns that have either banned plastic bags or levied a fee on them. And Boston might be next. The city council is considering a bag ban, and the proposed ordinance would also put in place a 5-cent fee on any reusable plastic, recyclable paper, or compostable plastic bag sold by a retailer in Boston. Here's City Councilor Matt O'Malley addressing the council earlier today.
20 tons of plastic bags are in our residential single stream recycling stream every single month. It is not uncommon to see a plastic bag up in a tree or in a storm drain.
Well, the city council did not vote on the proposed plastic bag ban today. They'll have to take it up again next year. But let's talk a little bit more about the reason why cities even introduce these ordinances. Joining us now from New York City is Eric Goldstein. He's a senior attorney at the Natural Resources Defense Council and New York City Environment Director. He's been a supporter of New York City's ordinance, which charges 5 cents for bags. It's a law that will go into effect in February. Eric Goldstein, welcome to Radio Boston.
Good afternoon, Meghna.
Well, first of all, I wonder if you could just sort of quantify for us in New York, you know, what's the overall cost or the impact right now of plastic bags?
Plastic bags right here in New York are a first-class environmental nuisance. They contribute disproportionately to litter here. They're blowing across our sidewalks, collecting in our parks, hanging from our trees, clogging our storm drains, and polluting our local waterways. And the estimates are that we have 10 billion plastic bags every year here in New York City that are used once and thrown away. So we use them for a couple of minutes. They're a convenience, but they remain a problem in our environment for decades or even centuries.
10 billion a year. Wow. Now, why is it that New York opted for a 5-cent fee per bag versus an outright ban? Because in cities across the United States that have done the outright ban, they've seen, you know, a 60, 70% drop in the number of plastic bags.
Well, there are various different ways to skin the cat, and some municipalities have been enacting fees and some bans because, in part, New York City hoped to model the Washington, D.C. example. There, in Washington, there's a 5-cent fee, and all of the funds go to an environmental cleanup of a local waterway, and in many ways, that's killing two birds with one stone. So that was our initial attempt here in New York. And that's one of the reasons why the fee started getting some leverage. Also, there have been a number of legal challenges to the bans, but all of these approaches are after the same thing, which is reducing the amount of unnecessary waste we generate and that is polluting our environment.
Yeah. I'm hoping that New York has better luck than Washington did in using the fees generated by the plastic bag fee, because the Washington Post reported that D.C. has raised some $10 million from the 5-cent fee on plastic bags, but only a very limited amount of that has actually gone to cleaning up the Anacostia Waterway. So I wish you guys better luck in New York. But how did you overcome the concerns, which we're hearing here in Boston as well, of folks who are saying this is an extra burden on retailers and possibly an extra burden on low-income folks who, you know, they may not have the opportunity to always have that extra, you know, reusable bag, and, you know, every 5 or 10 cents really does matter to them?
Well, that issue is something of a red herring. First of all, as for the retailers, they get a portion of the fee. In fact, they'll be getting most of the fee here in New York. And again, we as shoppers, we're paying for those bags one way or another. Either we pay for them directly if we take them from the checkout counter, or we pay for them because the retailers incorporate the price of those bags into the cost of every other grocery item that we pick up. So one way or another, we're paying for them. This fee method has the benefit of allocating the cost where it belongs. If you're going to use a bag, you pay the cost for it. As for the lower income folks, this is a fee that no one has to pay. And ideally, people will bring reusable bags with them. They won't have to pay a penny. However, in the New York legislation, we also had a provision that provided that no fee would be collected from shoppers who participate in the Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program. So the food stamp program users are exempt from the fee. But more importantly, we think that banks and businesses and nonprofit and governmental agencies will be participating in making this program work and will be giving away free reusable bags. and consumers can use those for a year or so. I bet if the Patriots or the Red Sox gave away reusable bags on game day, you'd get a lot of people carrying around bags pretty quickly, and the switch would happen almost overnight.
Especially if the bag said, beat New York, I guarantee you. Well, Eric Goldstein is a senior attorney at the Natural Resources Defense Council and New York City Environment Director, talking to us on the fee for plastic bags that the City of New York will be implementing in February. Mr. Goldstein, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you, Megan.
Well, and as we said, the Boston City Council did not actually vote on the proposed ordinance on its plastic bag ban today. That means they'll be taking a look at that if they choose to in 2017. Neither did the council vote on a just cause eviction ordinance, which we've been reporting on as well over the course of the year. So it looks like the City Council will have a lot on its plate next year. So while we're talking about legislation, we wanted to bring you a quick update on major legislation at the federal level that we've been following. It's the $6 billion 21st Century Cures Act. That's the bill that's designed to modernize medicine, and it ran into some high-profile opposition from Senator Elizabeth Warren a few weeks ago. She objected to provisions of the bill that loosened regulations on the biotech and pharmaceutical industries. The bill also contains more discretionary funding for the National Institutes of Health and for the so-called cancer moonshot and for opioid abuse prevention. Well, the 21st Century Cures Act passed Congress in a bipartisan vote, and yesterday, President Obama signed it into law.
It's not always easy to remember, but being able to honor those we've lost in this way and to know that we may be able to prevent other families from feeling that same loss, that makes it a good day. And I'm confident that it will lead to better years and better lives for millions of Americans.
Well, we have covered the 21st Century Cures Act extensively on the show, including conversations with FDA watchdogs and the Mass Biotech Council. You can go back and listen to those segments at radioboston.org. Well, switching gears here, every year, the season of Christmas brings gifts and surprises. And in 2013, Laura DiGeronimo of Lemonster got a Christmas surprise, but definitely not the kind you'd welcome. WBUR's Erica Lance has the story in the latest installment of WBUR's Kind World series.
In 2013, Laura DiGeronimo was 25 and in love. She lived with her boyfriend, whom she dated for 4 years, and she knew something big was on the horizon.
Everybody was asking, what color's for the wedding? How's the seating going to go when you get married? When are you guys going to start having kids? Do you think you guys are going to have 2 kids or 3 kids? Wow, this sure would be a good place to have a wedding.
One day, her boyfriend said it was time for a heart-to-heart. She didn't know quite what to expect.
It was December 22nd, 2013. It was like 6 p.m. He said, we need to talk. I said, okay. And he said, I just think that things would be best for both of us if we broke up. He was done.
Done. She asked what she could do to make him stay, but he didn't budge. That night, they started packing his things. Three days later, on Christmas, her family asked the obvious question.
Where's the ring? I'm looking at a pile of gifts that are for him, and my heart's falling out. I didn't want to make it a downer.
So she shared the news with a smile and hid how deeply heartbroken she was.
I was trying to prove that I didn't need him or anybody, that I was just a self-contained island of a person.
But becoming an island wasn't what she needed. Things were about to get really bad.
It became really hard to get out of bed. I would wake up hours early for work and just lay in bed and look at my ceiling and look around the house at all the empty spaces on the wall where art that he and I had gotten together wasn't. And I just felt so scared.
She was scared about bills, so she kept her heat around 50 degrees and skimped on food. She was scared no one would ever love her. But she was scared for another reason, too.
I wasn't me.
She was crying a lot, and her house became littered with the remains of chores she was too overwhelmed to complete. mildewed clothes, garbage, sand. Laura had sunk into depression.
The dishes in my sink were probably about 2.5 to 3 feet high, piled in horrible stagnant water.
The dishes weren't the only thing piling up. It was a rough winter, and the mountains of snow outside her door felt like a symbol of her isolation.
My house is really small, and it's white. And the snow got so high that it looked as though my house was a set of windows built into a snow pile.
After each snowfall, ice crusted over with a horrible sheen that looked to her like the surface of the moon. She felt trapped and alone.
So then I just, in a really weak moment, I think on some level wanted somebody to say, "Hey, are you okay?" So I posted on Facebook.
She asked, "Hey, can anyone help me shovel or know someone with a plow I can hire?"
I watched it for a little bit and nobody, not one person, had responded to it.
That's Ruthie Brown of Winchendon. She didn't know Laura well. They had met at LensCrafters, where Laura is an optician, and they clicked.
Like, there's no way this girl can go home and do this by herself.
Yeah, I'd just gotten done doing our driveway and she was mentioning that Laura needed some help. My name's Bill Brown. I'm Ruthie's husband of 37 years.
36.
36 years.
You love me.
Ruthie convinced Laura to let them make the 40-minute drive to dig her out. They wanted to do it right away, while Laura was still at work.
We loaded the snowblower up, made sure it had gas in it, threw a couple shovels in the back of the truck, and went out there and looked at everything and said, "Eee."
Yeah, it was bad. But he got set up. Ruthie went inside to plug in the snowblower, and she saw the pile of dishes. So she washed them. She noticed the floors, so she swept them. Then she vacuumed and mopped. Laura was still at work, but just knowing someone was at her house helping out made her feel lighter. When she drove home that evening, she couldn't believe her eyes. Her driveway was clear, with wide paths to her porch. She was crying even before she reached the kitchen, which was cleaner than she'd seen it in ages.
Somebody cared. It felt like I could say, "Help." And it wasn't weak to need their help. It made me feel strong again.
When Laura saw Ruthie again at LensCrafters,
I stood up and just gave her a big hug. And I said, "You know, you're never going to know like what it means to me that you were so good to me."
Laura says the day Ruthie and Bill stepped up was a jump start for her. She wasn't alone. Of course, they brush it off. For them, it was natural.
If there's something you can do to help somebody or do something, you don't let that pass because you can't go back. You can never go back and try to help her again on that day.
It was nothing. But here I am talking about it, and I probably think about it every day.
Laura says when it comes down to it, Ruthie had no idea what she was going through, but she acted anyway.
She just needed to know that my dishes were dirty and that there was some soap right there and she could just pick it up and solve that problem. So it really has made me, like, want to be somebody who picks up the soap.
That's Laura DiGeronimo. WBUR Kind World producer Erica Lance brought us her story. Kind World is a WBUR series exploring the acts of kindness hidden all around us. For more Kind World stories, subscribe to the podcast or go to wbur.org/kindworld. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston. Welcome back. It's Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty, and it is now time for a midweek lift, and Bill Littlefield is here to provide it. He's host of NPR's Only a Game, where he talks sports on Saturdays, but on Wednesdays, he also vaults over the cubicle wall and joins us here on Radio Boston. Hi there, Bill.
I haven't vaulted over anything in quite a long time.
Well, you know,
but I appreciate that.
Given the way that you have with words, I decided to put a little metaphorical flourish in today's lead.
I enjoyed it.
Okay, well, let's talk about baseball first. Forget the metaphor. Let's talk literally about baseball, a sport ruled by tradition. We've talked about that a lot here, you and I. But there's one tradition that Major League Baseball seems like it's going to leave behind, and that's the tradition of hazing new players by making them dress up as women. Okay, so we've got a little bit of tape here from then Boston Red Sox rookie outfielder Brandon Moss reacting to a reporter when he was dressed up. Moss was as Wizard of Oz's Dorothy in that kind of costume back in 2007.
Do you ever think you'd be doing this? Well, I've done it for Halloween, but you know, never on a plane. So this would be a new experience.
You look good.
I think so.
Okay, so that was back in 2007, Bill. Why does it seem like Major League Baseball is leaving this tradition behind?
You know, the question that came to me as I sort of pondered this exceedingly significant issue, has there ever been a women's basketball team or a women's soccer team that's hazed its rookies by having them dress up as men?
No.
No. No, there hasn't. So. I think this is just a kind of reaction to the sensitivity that this is seen by people as a demeaning thing. And why should why should they be asked to dress up as women? It's silly. And the concept behind it is somehow you're going to make a fool of yourself by dressing up as a woman.
Yeah.
And I have no problem with rookies being asked to make fools of themselves. In fact, they do it all the time.
On the baseball field.
Ground balls go through their legs and they take called third strikes. So I don't know. Perhaps this is just something that's time is overdue.
Okay. Well, you know, obviously Major League Baseball is still played by all men, and there are no openly gay, lesbian, or transgender Major League Baseball players. So, I mean, about your point about sensitivity, I mean, in a way, it's right to be sensitive, is it?
Yeah.
Not?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Absolutely. No, don't get me wrong. It is. I think it is right to be sensitive, and it's also there's no particular connection between being told that you have to dress as Dorothy in The Wizard of Oz and sexual orientation.
Yeah.
It's just silly. But, it probably is a kind of a goofy thing. It's like the old, coaches used to insult their little league players by saying, you throw like a girl. There's two problems with that. One is the assumption that girls can't throw. And the other is the idea that coaches improve their players by insulting them,
mm-hmm.
which, both of which are...
Very wrong.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, I mean, see, to me, there's an arc, though, to be drawn between Major League Baseball making this change and ban or ending this kind of hazing and sort of at the collegiate level, the really kind of the dark stories we've been seeing right here in Massachusetts about male college sports teams and their treatment of women. Amherst College just being the latest.
Yeah, and Harvard before that. Yeah. And as you say, no lack of stories, and they're certainly not limited to New England. It's probably very much in tune with trying to kind of get some sort of handle on
so
that.
Why not? So I think it's great that Major League Baseball, at least in this small way, is taking a stand and saying that's not okay anymore.
I think it's great as long as it doesn't lead to even more dangerous hazing, like, hey, you're a rookie. Drink this fifth of tequila. That kind of crazy, stupid stuff goes on, too.
Yeah. Well, let's jump forward and talk about more stuff that usually goes on in the spring, namely the marathon, because even though it is cold outside, we do have some
it
Boston.
It certainly is.
Boston. It's going to get colder, too, but yep. We've got some Boston Marathon-related news out today, because the BAA this morning announced that Etsidi Baisa and Lemmy Haile, the champions of the 2016 marathon, both from Ethiopia, have officially entered the 2017 race, plus there's a whole bunch of other previous champs. So it looks like it's going to be a really great field for the 2017 marathon.
Yeah, and this delights people because they can see familiar names. And, of course, winning two in a row is always something that's more exciting than simply winning. Although
unless you're the winner.
Simply winning would seem to be exciting enough for me, as long as they don't, and I'm going to give you an opportunity to lead into the next part of this story, as long as they don't take away your winner's medal and give it to somebody else.
Teeing me up here for Rita Jepp, too. The 2014 champion of the marathon, officially stripped of her medal on doping charges, and the once second place winner is now the gold medal winner. So what happens?
Well, I guess what happens is that Diba gets the gold medal as long as Rita Jepto is willing to send it to her, or the laurel wreath, I would imagine, would be rather faded by now. But this is awful. And it happens in the Olympics from time to time as well. It takes a long time sometimes for them to catch the people who have used banned substances. And so 2 years later, you're told, oh, you know that bronze medal you got? It's going to be silver, or it's going to be gold because we kicked out two people for cheating. It's never quite the same as being able to stand on the podium and get the medal with people cheering.
Although some might say better late than never.
I suppose so.
Yeah, and I have to say my hat's off to all those people out there running this winter, getting ready for next spring. Bill Littlefield, host of NPR's Only a Game, which airs on Saturdays on WBUR at 7 a.m. and 7 p.m. Thanks so much.
Thank you, Meghna.
That's it for today. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston.